brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Kareem, I think, just the fact that he was so tall and it was difficult, challenging for him, I'm sure, when he was, you know, a young man and young, you know, playing. And so he kind of got introverted a little bit. And I think his days at UCLA, he kept to himself. I'm here to tell you that he was not that way in person. He was unbelievable nice guy. He was a captain. He led us in every single drill that we did. He was the first one in, last one out. Just tremendous individual, a gentleman all the way, and the most intelligent person you'd ever want. I mean, he was well-versed in everything. Books, music, you name it.
Jeff Webb is a retired NBA player who played for both the Milwaukee Bucks and the Phoenix Suns. He won an NBA championship with the Bucks in 1971, playing alongside Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Oscar Robertson. As a college player at Kansas State University, he played for two coaching legends in Tex Winter and Cotton Fitzsimmons. Following his playing career, Jeff worked as a rep for Converse and worked on some of the earliest shoe deals with schools and coaches across the country. Hey, Hoopheads, this March, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $2,000 off the Dr. Dish All-Star, Rebel, and CT Plus. And don't forget their Anything Is Possible giveaway, too. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT Plus models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details.
Hi, this is Todd Kowalczyk, head basketball coach at the University of Toledo. You're listening to the Hoop Heads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Get ready to hear some great stories from the game's history as you listen to this episode with former NBA player Jeff Webb. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Jeff Webb, former NBA player, a guy who grew up in the same hometown as my dad, West Dallas, Wisconsin. Jeff, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you, Mike. It's nice to be here.
Excited to have you on. Looking forward to talking to you about all the different things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball career and your post-basketball career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid growing up in the Milwaukee area. Tell us a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember.
Well, we're talking many, many years ago, obviously. My memory serves me correct. I didn't start playing basketball till I was probably in fifth grade, which would have been somewhere in the mid to late 1950s. And back in those days, Mike, a lot of us at that time did more than just play basketball. I mean, we were involved in baseball, football, track, golf, tennis, you name it, bowling, pool, you know, badminton, horseshoes, you name it. We did everything. But that's just what everyone did. So we just traded in one pair of shoes for another pair of shoes. And I was still a pretty small kid. I was only 80 pounds maybe back then. So I was pretty small at the time. So I was still struggling to kind of even be able to shoot the basketball up to the rim, to be honest with you. So my memories of it were basically in grade school starting.
How do you feel about the basketball system that we have today, where kids, they specialize earlier, they're playing pretty much basketball year round, compared to the way you grew up is similar to the way I grew up, where I played everything in the neighborhood, chasing around with kids. And obviously I played a lot of basketball and it was my favorite, but at the same time, I was playing pickup baseball down in the sand lot and I was playing tackle football in the backyard and playing tennis with friends and all those kinds of things. So just when you think about your own upbringing and maybe even distancing itself from basketball, but just in terms of your childhood around sports, just talk a little bit about how much that impacted you as an athlete and just how much you enjoyed your childhood.
Well, and that's an excellent question, Mike. I wish sometimes that I say to myself, I wish everybody could play sports because, you know, it not only teaches you discipline, but, you know, it teaches how to deal with people and how to deal with adversity, how to deal with success. You know, you learn through the rewards of your preparation and your dedication and sacrifice. And the more that you can be a little bit more well-rounded regarding just not strictly one sport, you meet many different people from all different walks of life. And I think it just blends you into a much better person because of it. And those, all those different sports and all those different disciplines, I think can help you in the long run.
When you were playing, I'm assuming that while you were out in the neighborhood playing, you guys made up your own rules and you kind of had to figure things out on your own. And I know I see this as a phys ed teacher every single day when I go into school, that kids have a hard time today organizing themselves into teams and sort of trying to navigate how to make sure that the game is being played fairly. Whereas you think back in time to when you or I were growing up and we kind of figured that stuff out on our own because there just wasn't parents around in the same way we are today. And I feel like kids today kind of rely on the adults and we sometimes cheat them out of that ability to lead and figure things out on their own. Do you remember anything making special rules for your baseball games and basketball games?
Oh, as you were going sure. Playing? You know, I mean, sandlot baseball, you know, just divide up into teams and just throw it out. You know, the fields were terrible, muddy and bumpy. You know, they don't have the nice manicured fields that they do now, but, you know, and same thing with basketball. You just would split up and, you know, and I used to ride my bike down to different parts of Milwaukee to play against all different types of players. And, you know, you learn that way. You meet different people from all over the city. And, you know, who does that nowadays? I don't know.
Nobody does. I can tell you that. It just, especially when you're talking about playing outdoors, kids today, especially at a high level, those players for sure don't play outdoors. I think you still see occasionally kids, at least in this neighborhood here in Cleveland, I'll sometimes see kids playing on the driveway, but you're talking about high school or college players playing outdoors. You just don't see that anymore. And of course, the other part of that is kids have a lot more access. There's a lot more gym access than there was when you and I were kids, where basically the gyms were locked up. You were forced to play outside if you wanted to play. Whereas kids today, they can get into a gym. But it is the pickup basketball scene is just not the same anymore because AAU has kind of taken that over. And so kids, my son's a junior in high school, and he spends a lot more time going to high school practices, AAU practices, playing in AAU tournaments than he does going and playing pickup basketball. And I still, for me, I feel like the way that I grew up, I wouldn't have wanted to change it because just like you, I felt like I got to go to lots of different places, play with lots of different people, different ages, different demographics, all that kind of thing, which I think in the long run made me a better player, but it also, I think, made me a better person because I had to kind of figure that stuff out. It sounds like you feel the same way.
Oh, I agree 100%. Yeah, I think, you know, you got to be a little street smart. Especially if you live in, now were you raised in Cleveland?
I was raised in a suburb of Cleveland, Strongsville. So I started out, my dad was, just full disclosure for our listeners, Jeff and I, as I was doing my research, Jeff and my father grew up in the same part of Milwaukee. And my dad moved away. He actually went to Ohio State for grad school. He had started out teaching in the Milwaukee area, and then he ended up going back to Ohio State to get his doctorate, and he ended up being a professor at Cleveland State. So I grew up in a suburb of Cleveland, started out, was born in Columbus, and then ended up coming up here to a suburb of Cleveland. But again, went and traveled all over the place to be able to find games as I got older. And I was able to either hitch a ride with one of my older friends in their car, or eventually when I could drive, just try to go and find games so I could play and get better.
So true. Yes. Summer leagues were a real big one, you know, especially when I was in high school and college. And then ironically, for whatever reason, they stopped doing it. I guess that's when things all started changing, where people, you're right, didn't play outdoors any longer, and club basketball, I guess, came into play. I'm not quite sure.
I think it was a combination. I think it was a combination of just club basketball kind of taking over. I also think it's, we parent our kids differently. Certainly, I know that my wife and I keep closer tabs on our kids than my parents kept on me, at least in terms of knowing exactly where they are, and they've got their phone and you can be in touch with them at any moment. So it's certainly different from that respect. When you think back to your time as a high school player, what do you remember about just how you went about getting better as you got more serious about the game? How much time were you spending playing versus kind of working on your game on your own? Or just what was your methodology for trying to improve yourself?
Well, and again, that's another excellent question. My memory serves me correct that I would, as I said, I didn't have my driver's license till late in my life. And so I actually rode my bike, and I rode to different locations that were known to be, you know, the best places to play. And, you know, I learned early on that if you wanted to be the best type of player, you had to play against, you know, the African-American basketball player, because they are the best and they have always been the best. And so my game was predicated upon finding the best places to play against, you know, the African-American basketball player. And I cut my teeth on that, and you know, it came to fruition because of it.
Did you have somebody that was older than you that kind of served as your mentor? Was there anybody that was playing maybe in college while you were in high school, or just somebody that you looked up to, an adult that kind of took you under their wing at any point?
Well, not really, but I mean, being from Milwaukee, you know, we did not have a professional basketball team. We did in the early 50s. The Milwaukee Hawks played there between 1951 and 1955. But, you know, that was pretty early history. And so all we could look up to was Marquette University. Al McGuire, you know, yep, came in and did a pretty good job of bringing attention to. And that's who we used to follow. And I would go down to Marquette and play, you know, in their gyms, you know, all summer long. Names that jumped out at me, basically. I mean, I remember downtown Freddie Brown, who played at the University of Iowa and then later on the Seattle Supersonics. He would have been one. John Johnson, who played at the Cleveland Cavaliers and also at University of Iowa. Clarence Sherrod, who was at the University of Wisconsin. Dean Memminger, who played at Marquette with the New York Knicks. These are just a few of the guys that were my contemporaries that played during my time, and they all went on and were fortunate to play in the, you know, in the NBA.
Talk about your decision to go to Kansas State. How does that come to pass? Obviously, not necessarily geographically close. So what was it about Kansas State that attracted you to Kansas State, and just what was your recruitment like?
Well, I can back up a bit. When I went to high school, I went to a high school that was not too successful in sports across the board for whatever reason. Not many teams. We were very unsuccessful. The 3 years that I played in high school, we only won 11 times. So back in the 60s, if you didn't win, nobody came to recruit you because it just wasn't that sophisticated. I remember going to the state high school basketball championships in Madison with my dad in 64 and 65, or 63 was the first time I went. And all the major college coaches were there recruiting. They very seldom, and they certainly weren't going to come to a school that had a losing record. So, to answer your question, I didn't get a lot of notice, a lot of recommendation. University of Wisconsin showed a little bit of interest. Arquette, very little interest, because at that time, Al McGuire was mainly taking kids from Chicago and New York, which I don't blame him. That's where he was from. So I had a few interests from some local schools in the state of Wisconsin. Fortunately, there was a coach in our league by the name of Jack Nagel. And Jack Nagel used to coach at Whitefish Bay High School, a suburb of Milwaukee. And my college coach, Tex Winter, and Jack Nagel coached together at Marquette University between 1951 and 1953. So Tex had a little bit of a connection here in Milwaukee. Consequently, they offered me a scholarship sight unseen, and I jumped on it. And thank goodness, because it worked out pretty well for me.
Did you know anything about Kansas State before you went there?
Not really. I remember just hopping on a plane, one of the first times I ever was on a jet plane, 707, and flew from Milwaukee to Kansas City. And, I was sold.
What were your first impressions? Do you remember just of the campus, the team? What were you thinking as you land there?
Well, what I did learn was that, you know, Kansas State in the late 50s and early 60s were a pretty good team. I mean, they went to the Final Fours in 59, they went to the Final Four in 64. So Tex had a pretty, you know, good reputation. I didn't realize that because I wasn't at that point a historian of the game that I became. And there was a lot of pride, and they played in the Big Eight Conference. So we, you know, would play against, you know, University of Kansas, which has a, you know, plethora of history when it comes to basketball, as you know. So I just was thrilled that I had an opportunity to go someplace and, play a Division I basketball.
Obviously, Tex Winter, one of the giants in the history of the game, credited with the triangle offense. And obviously then that connects to Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson and the Bulls and his time there. What can you tell us about Tex Winter? What was he like as a coach? What was he just like as a person when you got there, and what was the experience like playing for him?
Well, Tex was originally, born in the state of Texas. Hence, he moved at a young age to California and had such an accent that that's where he got the nickname Tex. Lived in the Los Angeles area, eventually went to USC, played basketball, was a pole vaulter. I actually pole vaulted in myself too, so we had something in common. He worked for Jack Hartman in the early years. And when he became the head coach there in the early 50s and got off to a good start and incorporated the triangle offense, which, as you mentioned, led to, working with Phil Jackson and winning, what was it, 9 NBA championships with the Bulls and the Lakers?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So, it was, what can I say? It speaks for itself, you know.
When you're there and you're obviously thinking about going and improving and being the best basketball player that you can be, what was your thought process in terms of what you were trying to do for a career academically?
Well, at that time, going to a 4-year college, I had to get pretty serious because you're not going to stay in school unless you study and do what you're supposed to do. You are a student athlete. And my intentions were to, at that time, I thought I wanted to be a coach and teach. And I majored in history and physical education. So I thought I would either, you know, be a history teacher along with, you know, coaching. And those intentions followed through until I graduated. And I, as I told you, before I played professional basketball, I signed a teaching contract at, as I said, Racine Park, Washington Park High School in Racine, Wisconsin, for the tidy sum of $7,100 in case I didn't make it in playing basketball, at least I could fall back and, you know, become a teacher and a coach. So I only taught for 60 days, which is another whole story, but while I was trying out. And so I can't really say I had much of a teaching career.
A little different from how guys approach their NBA careers today in terms of prepping. You were teaching students at a high school, and now guys are going through all the training and different things that they do to prepare themselves for the draft and get ready for their first season. Obviously, a lot different experience. When you think back to your time at Kansas State, do you have a favorite memory that stands out, maybe a basketball memory that sticks out for you?
I think the one that stands out for me was more of a team, what we accomplished as a team. We were fortunate to win the Big Eight Championship in 1968, went to the Sweet 16, and then we won it also in 1970. Went to the Sweet 16, because back in those days, only 16 teams would go to the March Madness, which they call now, because you had to win your conference. A game that sticks out in my mind, let's see. I'd say let's use Allen Fieldhouse, where University of Kansas is. I mean, it's, you know, 17,000 people would attend every game, always a sellout. It was 1968. We were playing there. We were 7-3 at the time, and we were tied with Kansas to, you know, going toward the last part of the season. And it was a regional TV game. So not only did they have 17,000 fans, but also, you know, within that Big Eight conference, people were watching. So it was memorable because all five starters played the whole game, plus we played an overtime game, and none of us ever substituted. And Tex had gone on record saying it was, you know, he had some great victories in his career, but that one topped them all. So I think that says a lot. But it's almost hard to believe that we played the whole game and overtime and never once substituted. And we beat them 64-61. JoJo White later went on to Boston Celtics, played in that game, number of other people.
Being able to play that entire game and play overtime, you obviously don't see that very much. Just like the season when Wilt averaged 48.5 minutes per game, and now you look
there
at the
you
way.
Go.
Yeah, it's
there you go. Yeah, you don't see that anymore.
No, now you don't see it anymore. Yeah, there's a lot. Things are a lot different in terms of that. Just, I guess there's probably some science behind it, and yet at the same time, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, you think about how much time you spent just basically playing all day, and obviously there's a different level of intensity when you're playing in an NBA game than when you're a 16-year-old playing pickup basketball. But by the same token, it's just interesting how the game has evolved and it's different. And we're obviously never going to see anybody average 48.5 minutes per game in an NBA season the way Will did the one year. So it's kind of crazy. It's fun that you got a chance to do that. I know in my college career, I played, and at some point, I don't know, in the last year or two, I was kind of looking back, and I think I averaged like 37.5 minutes or something like that. My last 2 years, I think actually all three of the years that I started. So my sophomore through senior year. And you just look at that.
Really?
Yeah. It's kind of crazy when I think about, man, it's pretty much, I didn't come off the floor. And it's one of those things that you don't really, I don't think I appreciated it as much in the moment. And, but then looking back at it retrospectively, now having coached and having kids who have gone through the game, you know, you realize what a luxury that was to just be able to play and know that you could play through mistakes or you could play through missed shots and the buzzer wasn't going to sound and you weren't going to come out. And I think that that's one of those things that if you have that, it's a luxury. And I think sometimes I know I took it for granted. Let's put it that way.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly.
Much easier to play. Much easier to play without looking over your shoulder.
Isn't that the truth?
All right. So tell me a little bit about your 60-day teaching career. Give me the quick synopsis. I've got a 27-year teaching career going. So give me your 60-day synopsis of what it was like to be a teacher.
Well, I would teach during the day, and this was while I was trying out with the Bucks. And in those days, they would have rookie camp, and they would have two or three other camps, one at Marquette, one at, you know, all over. And you had to constantly get to each camp. Well, I was fortunate in the summertime. I wasn't teaching then, so I got through rookie camp okay. I wasn't drafted. There was 16 of us. I had walked in for a tryout and asked for a tryout. I wasn't, you know, I was a free agent, and I had got the last spot of the 16 participants. We then, as I got through that, and then when I finally got to go to the, it was at Carroll College in Waukesha, Wisconsin, where they had the veterans get involved. So they had two-a-days, and during the day I was teaching, so I couldn't attend the morning session, but I could attend the evening session. So I would drive from Racine to Waukesha, Wisconsin, which was about, I don't know, 40, 50 miles one way. And I would participate in the evening practice, turn around, go back home, and teach school during the day. And this went on for a good 7-8 days while camp was, and every day you didn't know if you were going to make or not. You'd read about the results in the newspaper. And if you made it, you stuck around. If you, you know, if you didn't, you were let go. And that's how that was that year when I was a rookie.
It's just funny. Again, I think when you really stop and think about it, that here's a guy trying out for professional basketball and you're slogging your way through a teaching day and then making it to the second of two-a-day practices. It really is unbelievable when you look at, you go to an NBA game today and you just see the vast number of people who have jobs, careers associated around the team, around the game, around the players. And it really is amazing the industry that it spawned, considering sort of the humble beginnings back when you were involved. And like I said, you're teaching during the day and then trying to make an NBA team later on. It's pretty crazy that that's the situation.
It's Neanderthal. It's Neanderthal when you think of it compared to the way they pamper the, you know, players nowadays. And I'm not, hey, I don't blame them, you know.
Yeah, no, and absolutely.
You know, they deserve it. You know, that's, the game is going on. We stand on the shoulders of giants, and
for
thanks
sure
to the people before us and the ones that, you know, that, and, you know, that's the way it is.
Tell me how you felt when you made the Bucks. What was that like, the moment when they tell you, hey, you're going to be on the team? You've made it into the NBA.
Well,
you've accomplished your dream.
Yeah, that's true. Back to the final practice we had that one evening, my dad happened to be watching, I guess, and, you know, I don't quite remember. They must have let people into the gym, you know, whatever. And it wasn't that big of a deal back then, but. And the coaches were all standing around in the corner, and they were talking. And I think they called me over and told me, "Well, go ahead and give notice at your school. You've made the team. We're getting ready to leave for preseason. We're going to Hawaii and play at that time we played 10 preseason games." And I remember turning around and giving a thumbs up to my dad, who was in the, you know, up in this, and, you know, that was how I told him.
That's cool.
And and again, back in those days, you used to they would talk to the reporters, the coaches, and that, and management, and they would tell the the newspapers, the Milwaukee Journal, the Milwaukee Sentinel at the time, you know, what was going on. And I'd wake up the next morning and read about it in the newspaper. Nobody ever told you anything. They'd say Webb beat out so and so or whatever, still a buck, and whatever. And that's how you learned if you were making it.
What's that first training camp like in Hawaii?
Well, that was, needless to say, it was, quite a wonderful experience, having never been to Hawaii.
And, that's a good venue.
Yeah, not too bad, And so it just, the first of all, the odds of even, making an NBA team. I know you know this, but, the statistics are pretty mind-boggling to, what is it, out of, I think the NCAA did a study years, maybe back in 2020, I read something where only out of 550,000 male high school basketball players, only 3.5% ever move on to a division, play basketball. Yeah. Out of 500,000, maybe only 18,000 go on to play. And out of those 18,000, only 1.2% make a jump to the NBA. I mean, when I played, there were 17 NBA teams, and they had 12 players each, which was what, approximately, maybe 200 some players out of all that played, college basketball. Now there's 30 teams, and there's roughly, 360 some approximately. So, the odds are, pretty small that you're even going to get a chance to play on an NBA team, let alone win a championship. And I don't need to tell you how difficult it is to win a championship. I mean, took the Chicago Cubs 108 years to win a World Series. The Red Sox, 86 years?
Yep. I was there for that Cubs win.
Were you really?
Yeah, so I don't even know if I've ever told this story on the podcast, but I'll tell it quick if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
So obviously it's the Cubs, and I'm from Cleveland, so it's the Cubs and the Indians. And I have a friend that I played college basketball with. His name is Greg Derbyshire, and he runs the company Pro Camps now. So he runs basically camps for pro athletes all over the country, different sports, basketball, football, baseball, whatever. He runs sort of their summer camp. So he's done one with James Harden and Durant and Kyrie Irving and different people and whatever. So he and I were talking back and forth. And at that point, we had just been in touch. I think I had worked at Kyrie camp with him relatively recently. And so we were talking quite a bit. And my family and I, we were set up. My kids were, I guess, whatever. They were significantly younger than they are now. So they were probably in elementary school. Maybe one of them was in middle school. And so we were all kind of set up. We had some signs set up to support the Indians. And we were all getting ready to sit down and watch game 7 of the World Series. And my friend Greg calls me. He says, hey, he goes, I got a ticket for tonight's game. And, it's not a very good ticket, but, at least I got one. And I'm like, oh, that's great. I'm like, that's awesome that you're going to be there. You're going to be able to sit in on game 7. He goes, no, for you. And this is like at maybe 7:20 p.m. and the game was slated to start at 8. So
he had a ticket for you?
So he had a ticket for me. So I said, well, the family, we're all set up and, the kids are all excited. I'm like, I don't know if I can just get up and go. I said, I don't think I can take it. So I told him no, hung up the phone, and the kids and my wife were like, who was that? I'm like, oh, that's Greg. And, he said he's got a World Series ticket, for the game tonight. And they're like, dad, you got to go. So I called him back. I'm like, you didn't give the ticket away yet. And he's like, no, I didn't give it away yet. And I'm like, well, if you still are going to give it to me, I'll take it. And so family drives me down to downtown Cleveland. So it's about a 25, 30 minute drive. So we get down there at 5 minutes to 8, maybe. They drop me at the corner outside the stadium, and I've got to walk to
I've got to get the ticket because it's a physical. At that point, it was a physical ticket. It wasn't one that he could just transfer to me. So I'm trying to get to the stadium and be able to get where I can, where he can hand me the ticket like through a fence. But the way it was, there was this huge crowd of people outside the stadium that were just, you know, they're hanging out outside whatever game seven in this plaza between the Cavs arena and the Indian stadium. So I had to fight my way through this crowd. And then I finally get to the place where under normal circumstances, you could be right by the fence on the outside, but because of security, they had it blocked off by like maybe 10 feet. And so I kept having to try to tell these security guards, like the guy over there has my ticket. And security guard after security guard was like, no, you can't go over there. You can't go over there. So finally I found, after my maybe fourth or fifth security guard, I found a sympathetic security guard who let me kind of break through the security line to go near the, stadium where I could reach and get the ticket from my friend Greg. So he hands me the ticket. And as he's handing me the ticket, there's this huge cheer. And I was like, oh, the game just had to have started. So the Indians must have had a big strikeout or got a double play or whatever. But turned out that once I got in the stadium, I realized that the stadium was half filled with Cubs fans. And so it was the weirdest experience because it was seriously 50-50 between the Cubs and the Indians. So whenever anything would happen for either team, it would just be so loud and crazy. And obviously both fan bases starved for winning a World Series, clearly. So it was just a very, very unique experience. And then obviously the Indians.
Oh, that is. Yeah.
It's actually almost better to have 50-50 in a way.
Yeah, it was kind of, I mean, it was strange. It was strange to be in a home stadium and have the visiting team score or do something and have people cheering that. It was a little disconcerting. It was weird, that's but it was true. Also, it also made the atmosphere unlike any sporting event I've ever been to. It was just, no matter what happened, it was super loud. And then obviously there was a rain delay and the Indians hit the home run off Aroldis Chapman to tie it, which was probably the loudest building I've ever been in my entire life. And then the Cubs winning it. And so it was a crazy night. So
they won it in Cleveland?
They won it in Cleveland. Won it in Cleveland. And it went to extra innings. There was a rain delay, I think, after the ninth, maybe. It was either after the eighth or the ninth, and then it went extra innings and Cubs scored a couple runs, and that was it. So, but it was Mike, a lot of fun.
Mike, did the Cleveland win it in 1948?
Yeah, 48 was the last time. Yep.
Was that Bob Feller?
I believe so.
I'm not sure, but they won in 48.
I believe that's the last one. So, and then we got one with the Cavs. So that was fun. I never thought I would see that in my lifetime, to be honest. So
it doesn't happen a lot. It just does not happen.
Yeah, it's not as easy as you said. It's not as easy as you think. Well, you did have two pretty good teammates that helped you to accomplish what you accomplished in Milwaukee. Oh, yeah. So talk a little bit about what it was like to play with. At that time, he was still Lou Alcindor and the Big O. What was it like playing with those two guys? Just, again, obviously incredible players, but just tell me a little bit about being their teammate and what that was like.
Well, I'll start with Kareem. A little bit I know. I mean, as you know, take your mind back to when he was, you know, young. He was probably the most famous recruit ever. If you think about it, he went to the Manta Catholic School, and I'm sorry, he went to a school in New York City. And I didn't realize at the time, but I mean, he never lost. I mean, they won 71 wins in high school and one loss in high school. They won 88 times in college and only lost twice in 3 years of college. I mean, he just, you know, they changed the rules because of him. In 1967, this allowed dunking.
Yep.
Because of him. So he comes in, you know, the coin toss, and fortunately, you know, Wisconsin, Milwaukee got that. And changed the, you know, fortunes forever for at least the next 7 years. And after his first year leading the 56 victories, they, you know, we ended up winning it with a 66-16 record. And obviously the thing that made it go, the key to that was getting Oscar to come on board. And Oscar had played 10 years with Cincinnati Royals before that. And you know all the stories about him, you know, averaging a triple-double. But a lot of people may not realize that over a five-year period, he had 30 points a game, 10 assists a game, and 10 rebounds. I mean, the guy was just phenomenal long before anybody really knew what, you know, before the
triple-double was a thing, right? Before it was a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
He was doing it well before that.
Yeah. And so they just were a great team together. And I think Oscar was smart enough to know that how to get Kareem the closest to the back, you know, the basket with his, patent sky hook. And they didn't need to do, you know, pick and roll. It just didn't work for them. So they would, Larry set up this offense that actually had a little bit of triple post to it. You know, we would pass in to Kareem and then cut off to him. And then he would, if he didn't see anybody open, he would, you know, do his patent sky hook. So, and, you know, we were lucky to win. We had 16 game winning streak one time. We had a 10 game winning streak that year, and we had a 20 game winning streak, which set the NBA record, which the Knicks had set the year before with 18 straight. And then we swept the Washington Bullets four straight games in the finals, which only had happened once before. So it was a special year, thanks to those two guys.
Both of those guys kind of had a reputation as being maybe a little bit prickly, a little bit sort of reserved and kind of not, maybe not as outgoing with the media, at least. What do you remember about them as teammates sort of behind the scenes? What kind of guys were they to be teammates with? Maybe not so much on the court, but in the locker room and just sort of hanging out.
Well, Kareem, I think, just the fact that, you know, he was so tall and people, you know, it was difficult, challenging for him, I'm sure, when he was, you know, a young man and young, you know, playing. And so he kind of got introverted a little bit. And I think his days at UCLA, he, you know, kept to himself. When he got into the NBA, he was, but I'm here to tell you that he was not that way in person. He was unbelievable nice guy. He was a captain. He led us in every single drill that we did. He was the first one in for the last one out. Just a tremendous individual, a gentleman all the way, and the most intelligent person you'd ever want. I mean, he was well-versed in everything, books, music, you name it, jazz. Oscar, on the other hand, is, I don't need to say, everyone said everything there is about him. He was a professor on this floor. He'd an orchestra leader. He would tell everyone where to be the right time. Sure, he was a little bit, he was a general, but I mean, you needed that direction, and it showed in the results. And I can remember as a rookie playing against him, and all I knew at the time was if I'm going to impress anybody, it had to be him. So I tried to guard him as much as I could. And here he was, 6'4", 6'5", 220 pounds. And I was 6'4", 180 pounds. So, you know, I bounced off of him, you know, but yet what else can you do? So I was just fortunate to be able to play with two of the best that ever played. And I got a ring to show for it, thanks to them.
Do you have a favorite game in that run to the championship, one that stands out?
Well, let me see. One part, there was a time, it was in February, I think. We were, you know, doing quite well. I mean, we might have been 14 games ahead of our next competition, which might have been Chicago at that time, the Bulls. And Lucius Allen, who was the fourth guard at that time, who, you know, played with Kareem at UCLA, hurt his back. And I had a chance to move up to play third guard and give either John McLaughlin or Oscar, you know, a breather. But we were playing against, out in San Francisco, playing against the Warriors at the time. And I was a third guard. I went in and did a decent job playing defense. And Larry Costello commented on it. And I ended up being the third guard, obviously, at that time. And we won that game. And we went home the next day. I should say the next game we played against the Phoenix Suns. And my former college coach, Cotton Fitzsimmons, who was the head coach of the Phoenix Suns at that time. And I had one of my better games, scored 8 points. We won that game, and again, being the third guard. And the whole point of this is that we proceeded to go on a 20-game winning streak, which set the NBA record. Now, I'm not saying it was because of me, but the point is that we started, ironically, winning during that time, and we ended up winning 20 games. And, you know, that was the time that Lucius, you know, eventually came back, and I went back to, you know, the next guard after him, fourth guard, I should say. And, but, you know, I feel, you know, that I had a, you know, something to do, you know, regarding that, successful run of victories.
Who are some of the opponents that, when you think back to that time, that really impressed you, guys that you played against who stood out? And obviously there's lots of big names, but just who are some of the guys that, when you think about, man, that guy was unbelievable? Obviously Kareem and Oscar fit the bill. You're playing with them every single day, but who are some of the opponents that stick out for you?
Well, I think, you know, let me just say, we always had a challenge playing against the Knicks at that time. Willis Reed, Clyde Frazier, Bill Bradley, Dave DeBuscher, always played us very tough. And they ended up losing to the Baltimore Bullets in the semifinals, and we didn't have to play them in the finals. Now, right off the top, you'd have to say Will Chamberlain, you know, was still playing. So right there, I mean, you're talking, you know, one of the all-time greatest. Earl of Pearl. I mean, Connie Hawkins. I mean, you had Dave Bing. You had John Havlicek. You had... I mean, there are just so many to choose from. It's hard to, you know, I mean, Pete Maravich came out in 1970 when I also was a rookie. He was a rookie. And obviously the highest scoring college player ever, averaging 40 some points a game. You had,
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
Let me ask you this about Wilt. So I've maintained, and again, Wilt predates most of what I've seen of Wilt is grainy highlights and me reading about him and hearing things and whatever. But I'm always curious because when I look at Wilt Chamberlain and I look at the numbers and I look at the athleticism and I watch him play with his contemporaries, guys who were the very best at that time, and his athleticism to me just stands out. And I always have told people that I think if there was any player from the past that you could just take them, and I don't mean take them and raise them in this era where they could have the benefits of the nutrition and the weight training and all the different things that we know about today, but just take 1962 Wilt Chamberlain and plop him into an NBA game today. He's the one person that I feel like, because of just what an unbelievable athlete he is, that he could hold his own easily in an NBA game today just because of his athleticism. So am I crazy, or is that something that you saw up close and personal? Just, I'm curious to get your take on that.
No, Mike, you're absolutely right. And again, it's all relative. I mean, you got to remember he could high jump 6'11".
Yep.
And the guy was a phenomenal volleyball player. I mean, he was one of the fastest guys on the team at the University of Kansas. Same thing with Kareem. These guys were phenomenal athletes. And you're absolutely right. You hear old time players always say, "Oh, back when I played," but it's all relative. I mean, at the time, I mean, somebody who averages 50 points a game, who scored 100 points, I mean, he was the Michael Jordan of his day.
Yep.
And even more so because he also, got 20 rebounds a game and also led the NBA in assists one year. So, I mean, he did it all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, we talked about it earlier, but averaging 48.5 minutes a game, and the 100 points obviously is ridiculous, and it's hard to even fathom or imagine what that would have looked like. And, it's such a shame that there is no video of that. But I even think that the idea of averaging 50 a game to me is even more remarkable because, you have a bad game and you get 30 and you got to get 70 the next game to keep your average. That's a pretty high standard to hold yourself to. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, it's mind boggling to even think about what he had to do. Yeah,
it really is. It's incredible. All right, let's talk about the end of your career and then where you go after you finish playing. So I'm sure your career didn't last quite as long as you hoped. So talk a little bit about the end of your career and then the transition from the NBA into what you ended up doing next.
Well, I was fortunate to play for the Phoenix Suns. My college coach, as I mentioned earlier, Cotton Fitzsimmons, had commented after that one good game. He said, if ever there's an opportunity to, pick up Webb, I'm going to do it. And he did. And so I was fortunate to just play about a half a year in Phoenix with him, 1972. And so not only did I play with the Bucks, but I also played with the Suns. So, and then he left the following year. And at that time, it was called Kansas City. Omaha had an NBA team, and he went to coach there and then obviously went on to many other places after that. And when I got done playing there, I didn't make the team the following year. So I was approached by a gentleman by the name of Hot Rod Huntley, who had played with Jerry West at West Virginia. And Hot Rod had played in the NBA. And he said, "Hey, there's an opportunity to go to work for a company called Converse." And in those days, Converse was the basketball shoe, just like Nike is. And they had an opportunity at that time, they were hiring former players and coaches to act as consultants throughout the United States. And I took a position in Dallas, Texas to cover the states, call on universities and NBA teams throughout Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. And I did that for 7 years. And that was kind of the beginning of, where we would pay players to wear your shoes. And that was just the start of it. This was before Adidas and before Nike was even a player. So that's how, you know, we used to, everyone played in Congress, as you probably, maybe you remember that, maybe you don't.
I do, for sure. I started out on my driveway in my Chuck Taylors. And eventually I remember when I got my, I had pined away for the Dr. J Leather All-Stars for probably a year and a half or 2 years before I finally got my first pair. I think I was in seventh grade. So that would have probably been like 1981, 82, somewhere in there. And then I got my first pair of leather Converse basketball shoes. And I was always a Converse guy growing up. I don't think I switched to Nike until I think Air Jordan is what switched me over. So when I was in 10th grade, yeah, which would have been 1986. 1986.
I think that's when Air Jordan, wasn't it?
Yep. And so the first, my first pair of non-Converse shoes were Air Jordans. And then obviously the basketball world slowly over time kind of transitioned. But when you're working for Converse, who are some of the coaches that you had an opportunity to interact with and talk to in the course of that job?
Well, one that jumps out at me is Eddie Sutton. Used to be at he was at Creighton when I was in college, and then he left there and went to Arkansas, and then he eventually went to Kentucky and so on. It was Hank Iba had retired at Oklahoma State University, but all the schools that were in the Southwest Conference back in those days, University of Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma. And those coaches are obviously long gone, but, you know, we would attempt to get them to wear our shoes. I can remember, Mike, when Nike had just come out and they were going in, and Converse, you know, had probably 90% of the business, and Nike was coming in saying, hey, just wear this one to one, wear this shoe. It's a brand new shoe. And some of the, I have to laugh now because look at where they're, you know, they are today.
But right.
They were struggling to get one or two people to wear their shoe. And I can't believe that that's, I'm saying that, but because of where they are now, you know, but they had a challenging time getting people to, you know, Phil Knight did a great job in promoting that, and look at where it is now.
Yeah, crazy. Again, you just hard work, a lot of hustle, a lot of effort, and eventually a good product. But yeah, it's kind of incredible, again, when you think about just how Converse had the market completely cornered, and slowly over time, obviously, things change and taste change. And so it's not completely surprising. And yet in some ways, what's interesting is that kids today, they don't wear their Converse Chuck Taylors to play basketball in, but they wear them everywhere, all over the place. You see way more Chuck Taylors today than you did certainly 10 years ago. It's like we went from 1976 and they kind of disappeared for a long time.
Yes, Mike, you're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I got a pair of myself, a little low cut black. I sold a lot of those. 91.
I got a high top black pair of leather that's really? Leather. That
no.
And I actually went to I think this was maybe 2 years ago, I went to a Converse outlet store in Columbus, Ohio, and I probably bought, I don't know, four or five different pairs of Converse, and one of them was the black leather Chuck Taylors, but I also bought a couple other different pairs of Converse. It's kind of like a blast from the past. I'm like, here I am, a 50-year-old guy, and I'm in the sneaker store just buying Converse shoes, trying to relive my youth. And it's funny because for many years I taught in the classroom, and so, you know, I wore dress clothes to work every day. And then about 10 years ago, I had an opportunity to move and teach phys ed at my school. And now I dress like I'm 15. I can go out and buy t-shirts and shorts and sneakers and all kinds of stuff. So it's definitely been it's definitely been like a renaissance for me to go back and kind of relive my youth. It's kind of funny how that all works.
Mike, are you still teaching now?
I'm still teaching. Yeah, I'm still teaching. So I teach elementary school phys ed. So I'm in a K-6 building.
Dude,
and I've been doing it 27 years at the same school. I taught third grade in the classroom for 4 years, I guess. And then I taught about 15 years as a fifth grade teacher in the classroom. And then, like I said, had an opportunity to move from the classroom into the gym about 10 years ago. It was a good change for me. And I've been there ever since. And state of Ohio changed the retirement rules. So I would have been able to retire at 30 years. And I actually have 2 years in like another retirement system. So I'd have been probably less than a year away from retirement or the old system, but now I've got an extra 5 years to go. So, but I'll make it through. I'll make it through.
You will. Yeah. You're still young enough. I've got teachers in my family. My daughter just retired from 30 years of teaching. My brother was retired in teaching. I tried to carry it on, but obviously it was waylaid.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's a noble career, and I really respect anybody who, you know, is involved in it. Very challenging nowadays, I understand, but good for you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, it's definitely challenging. I think it gets more challenging every year. I think the combination of it just does get more challenging every year. And I think every year you get a little bit older. You maybe have a little less patience than you did when you were 25. And so I think you have to fight that and figure out ways to make it work and still realize and remember that you are having an impact on the students that you have in front of you every day. And that's what I try to start my day every day with, is just thinking about, you know, how can I make that positive impact for the kids that I'm working with despite the challenges. So it's all good. It's all good.
Mike, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
How do you know Tim Gallagher?
Okay. So I know Tim Gallagher through, I have a friend, his name is Kim Otten, and Kim's sons went to my basketball camp when they were younger. So that's how I initially met Kim. And so Kim had actually, his two sons, they're adopted. It's a long family story, but nonetheless, he's raising them as his two sons, and they have come to my basketball camp for years and years and years. And so in the course of that, I got to know Kim and have had conversations with him. And at some point, Kim started listening to the podcast, and he told me, hey, I've got a guy that I think would make a really interesting guest. And he gave me Tim's name. He also gave me the name of the high school coach at Centerville High School here in the state of Ohio, which is where Tim and Kim went to high school. They both grew up in Centerville, Ohio, and then went to Centerville High School. So Kim said, you should talk to Tim. So I ended up getting in touch with Tim and talking to him back and forth, kind of like what you and I did before the podcast, and got to know him. And then he came on the show, and we did an hour, hour and a half. I can't remember how long the episode was back when we did it. And I got to hear some of his stories about card collecting and just getting autographs and all the different things and people that he's been able to get in contact with. And then what's been really fun, and I think this is one of the things that we didn't really know this when we started the podcast, but it's been something that has been really special to us, is that we've been able to develop relationships with the people who have come on, because you have a conversation with somebody and you make a connection, and then you're able to stay in touch with them. So Tim and I have stayed in touch, and we've texted back and forth. And just like Tim recommended you as a great guest to come on the podcast, he's recommended numerous other people. And so he and I have texted back and forth multiple times since he's been on, and he's been nice enough that as he kind of thinks of people that would be good guests, he opens up his Rolodex and sends me their contact information, and here we are. So it's a connection indirectly through somebody that I know, again, through obviously basketball, which, as you know, is a very small and tight-knit circle. It doesn't take very long to get from one person to the next.
No, it doesn't. And isn't that, excuse me, it's a nice common denominator. I mean, it's gotten me through my life, and as it has you, as far as making friends and acquaintances and lifelong, you know, people that you've respected. And thanks to basketball, that's what it's done.
Absolutely. So tell me your connection to Tim.
Well, I met Tim years ago. Between 1985 and 1990, I lived in La Jolla, California, and Tim was out there, and we played basketball at the local rec there, and and we got to know all kinds of guys that played basketball out there. And I'm sure Tim shared with you his time there and still, as you know, lives there. And then we've stayed in touch, just like you said you did, you know, how you have with Tim now. And we've, he is so chock full of information when it comes to basketball. And, you know, he has stories to tell and he could go on for days and they're interesting. Keeps me abreast of what's going on by sending me articles, and I love it. So it keeps me somewhat current, you know, otherwise I wouldn't care, you know, but thanks to him.
Keeps you in the loop, right?
Yeah, he does.
How much do you follow? Do you follow the game at all now?
From a distance, you know, I mean, it's hard to, I mean, how do I say this without, you know, I mean, having been involved in sports for over, you know, 55 of my years, you've seen every kind of game, you've been involved in every kind of game, and they all start running together. Do I follow? Yes, I know enough to talk about it, but I don't, you know, don't really particularly, I don't hardly watch, I never watch NBA, to be honest with you. Maybe the finals I might. College I enjoy. But I've actually enjoyed more college football than I do basketball, but I do know enough about it to, I guess, to be in trouble.
You know? Just enough to be dangerous, right?
Yeah, you know what I mean. So.
I know exactly.
I guess, you know, once you're in it, you're always in it. So who am I kidding? You know?
When you look back on your life in basketball and you think about some of the lessons that the game taught you over the course of your time, both as a player and then what you did with Converse and just as a fan and watching it, can you kind of quantify or maybe put how the game has impacted your life for the better? Because I think that anybody who loves the game always feels like that they took more from the game than what they were able to give back, that the game gave them so much. So I don't know if you can put into words just what the game's meant to you and the impact that it's had on your life.
I mean, it's meant everything when you think about it. I mean, come on. Again, it's a game. And, you know, throwing a little round ball through a hoop, it got me to college. It got me off to a good start in my career. Everything that I ever did was a direct result of playing that game. And I think probably as far as personality trait, I can remember when I was a young kid and I was, you know, I was a hothead and I hated losing and I would lose my cool. And I realized early on because of it, I said, you can't ever show your opponent that you've lost your cool. Once you do that, you are done. And I've made myself to be even keel and never, ever show your opponent that you've lost it. Because once you do that, as you know, you lose it. And I think it's just through adversity that you grow stronger. And I think maybe some of the younger kids today need to be, don't lose your cool. You know, that's all I can say. It's just been a attribute of the wonderful game. It's I wouldn't be where I am today without it.
I could not agree more. I think that when I look at my experiences with the game, I think that ability to maintain your cool is definitely something that I developed over time. I can remember being a real young kid and shooting free throws with my dad and having a contest of who could make more out of 100 and losing and slamming the ball down and yelling and screaming. And then gradually, I think as I matured as a player, I came to that same realization that you did, that I had to be able to maintain my composure in order to be at my best. And I do think that what the game has given to me, just like it's given to you, is I can't imagine my life without it. Like all the things that I've done in some way, shape, or form always kind of lead me back to the game of basketball. And it's just interesting how many people have that same experience. And I'm going to give you a book recommendation that a guy we just recently had on the podcast, and he's a professor at New York University, and the book is called How Basketball Can Save the World. And the author's name is Dave Hollander. And it's a book that kind of summarizes what you and I just talked about, how the game has been so important to so many people. But he kind of frames it in a sense of how can the things that we've learned through basketball help us to solve and understand real problems in the world. And it's just a super interesting book, the way he weaves stories of the game into stories of geopolitical things and stories of how we can solve some of the world's crises that are out there. And it's just a really interesting book. And it's one that, since I had Dave on the podcast, that I've been recommending to tons of people. And I feel like after talking to you, you're somebody that would really enjoy that book without
question. So How Basketball Saved the World?
How Basketball Can Save the World.
Can Save the World by Dave Hollander.
That's correct.
Okay.
So I would highly recommend it.
Okay. No, I'll follow up on that, Mike. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Jeff, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us. It's been an absolute pleasure getting a chance to talk to you, learn a little bit more about your journey as a basketball player and as a person. And I really want to say thank you. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your coaching portfolio guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.